Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, the chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. We're honored today to have our guest, Professor William Hartley, retired professor of history from Brigham Young University. Bill is one of our great scholars on church history, and particularly the trek from Nauvoo to Salt Lake Valley. Bill, we're pleased to have you as our guest today on Past Impressions.
Thank you.
Bill, let's talk about the effect of the martyrdom. And so that June 27th, 1844, what impact does that have on the saints in and around Nauvoo? And how is that really a critical juncture in the history of ultimately the exodus of the saints from Nauvoo?
Okay, I would like to start our discussion today with the people, and I'd like to end with the people.
Great.
And some of this might be a review of sorts for some of your listeners, but we've got a situation that during the 2 years after the martyrdom, we need to get a sense of who they are and what's happening by looking at the people for just a minute. Nauvoo, you know, was a city. I compare it to on the runway trying to take off. It hadn't taken off. It was still trying to become what it was going to be. It was in process. By the time of the martyrdom, the city was only 5 years old, and the people were gathering from here and there and everywhere. They were struggling to become viable economically. Getting a job was hard if you came from England. Where do you find work? Mm-hmm. Joseph Smith had struggled to get industry started. Nauvoo needed more commerce. And again, our pool of people, I estimate, was about 11,500 in Nauvoo proper. Hmm. And Nauvoo, of course, was a hub of more Mormon settlements around and about. So we have Mormons in the county seat of Carthage. We have Mormons up in Ramus or Macedonia. We have Mormons south of Nauvoo in Morley Settlement. We have them in Warsaw. We have a ring of settlements across the river in Iowa, Montrose, and farther in Ambrosia. We have saints all around. So the population pool for me is about 17,000 people that we need to be concerned with in this discussion of the 2 years after the martyrdom. It was a mix of people. And to get a feel for the people, I was thinking about my own research on Nauvoo over the years, and I've researched a number of particular families, and it was interesting for me to figure out where they all came from. I had Ellisons and Corlisses from England. Mm. I had Butlers and Lewises from Kentucky, Egan from Massachusetts, Bunker from Maine, Knights and Durfees from New York, Higginbothams from Virginia, Berries from Tennessee, and Hunter from Pennsylvania. Huh. And this is the mix of people. Mm-hmm. Now, these Latter-day Saints are the heart of the church, but they hardly know each other, and they don't have a lot of experience in the church. They're what you'd call novice Mormons, mm-hmm, in most cases. Mm-hmm. And just to show a sense of the mixture, I came across a statement about the Butler family from Kentucky that I was studying, and a comment from a New England girl named Spencer. And she said, a 10-year-old girl recalled this. She said, "One thing which seemed very odd to me was the queer talk of some of the children. And no doubt our language was just as strange to them. We were regular Yankees and used to say stun for stone, while they, being Southerners, would say, I reckon, and quit that, instead of stop that. Uh-huh. In calling the cows, they would say, sook, bossy. And what we called hasty pudding, they called mush." Well, I mention that just to show that we've got a mingling of people that the church is going to have to help meld into this trek west. We had, by 1845, up to 4,000 British immigrants in Nauvoo.
Wow.
That's almost one quarter of the population pool. Mm-hmm. The church itself was finding itself administratively.
Mm-hmm.
That is, before Nauvoo, we tended to have a regional bishop, presiding bishop in Ohio, a presiding bishop in Missouri. And in Nauvoo, we have a presiding bishop, but the city grows. And as we get the population growing from the original, say, 7,000 that left Missouri in the when the extermination order mm-hmm. kicked us out, we start to say, how do we administer the city of Nauvoo? And as happens in all cities in the eastern states, we decided we should have municipal wards mm-hmm. so that we could run the city. Well, the church decided that we needed to have something more than just one bishop for the area, so we create a bishop in the municipal wards. And that's the beginning of a major church operation of ward bishops, so fundamental today.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just being discovered, so to speak, in Nauvoo. They did not have ward meetings. They didn't have ward organizations
or
per
buildings,
se.
Buildings, yeah.
And there were no churches whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So most people did not have a church calling.
Interesting, yeah.
By comparison. So,
well, Bill, why don't you continue and talk to us more about some of those things that are going on in Nauvoo that are setting the stage for important events that are going to happen with the Exodus.
Okay. I was mentioning how the church was kind of developing itself because of the numbers of people and the big collection of people we had to work with. Tithing had become a new system, basically. We did have a church newspaper that kept people informed. But in terms of meetings, we had a general meeting outdoors. There were no mm-hmm. indoor meeting places for all of the church. So the Sunday meetings were, what would we call them, stake?
Mm-hmm.
They were citywide general worship meetings. And usually one of the general authorities were the main speakers at those Sunday meetings.
It's hard for us to even imagine that general conference being held outside. So.
What really kept the people together where we didn't have wards and they didn't have ward positions and so on, there were two things I see keeping the people together. Joseph Smith, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And people wanted to hear his discussions on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, of course, was the temple. The martyrdom hit people right between the eyes. Mm-hmm. It was a devastating shock. And To get the shock value in, I've got a quote from Newell Knight, who had been a friend of Joseph Smith since before Joseph Smith received the gold plates. And he felt that loss so hard. He wrote in his diary at the time, he said, "Oh, how I love those men and rejoiced under their teachings. It seems as if all is gone, as if my very heartstrings will break. And were it not for my beloved wife and dear children, I feel as if I have nothing to live for and would rejoice to be with them in the courts on high." This shows mm-hmm. the impact on the people.
Very touching.
The 12, of course, are not in Nauvoo when the martyrdom happens. They're out on assignments, and they take time. As soon as they hear about the martyrdom, they return. But the people in Nauvoo are lost.
Mm-hmm.
They're confused. They're baffled, stung, hurt. I don't know, the range of emotions.
In fact, the comment that we're often familiar with is that they're like sheep without a shepherd, that they are totally lost in with what to do.
So what I see is the next year basically is a year of shock, of sadness, of disorientation. There were feelings to retaliate, but the good counsel said don't.
Mm-hmm.
Wait and see. One of the waiting and see elements was to see what happens with the trial of the persecute or the people who killed Joseph mm-hmm. and Hiram. And that trial was somewhat of a farce from our position. Men who were accused were indicted, couldn't be tried given the climate of anti-Mormon feeling. John Hay, who was a secretary later to Abraham Lincoln, said at the time, "Not a man on the jury, in the court, or in the county didn't know that they had done the murder."
Mm-hmm.
but they were found not guilty, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, as we've talked before on a previous program, was a little bit of the of what we call the transfiguration of Brigham Young, or the falling of Joseph's mantle onto Brigham Young. We talked a little bit about the significance of that event. Why don't you share with us some thoughts about how that is also linked to the future Exodus?
Well, again, the people are trying to figure out who's the leader. The first presidency existed. Joseph is dead. What happens next? And your previous programs, I think, have dealt with that. Sidney Rigdon wanted to be a caretaker, and there's a big conference on August 8th when Rigdon speaks in the morning and Brigham Young in the afternoon, and there's some kind of an experience, a transfiguration, either of appearance or voice or impression that the people see. And that seems to, by the accounts we have, the 57 or so first-person accounts later written, seems to give authorization that the 12 indeed are the successors to the presidency of the church. So there were some doubters, and I think you've dealt with those before. I had one quote from the Knight family. A young boy, Oliver DeMille, later said of that experience, he was there. He said, after talking about a minute, Brigham Young's voice changed to the voice of Joseph. His countenance and every appearance and motion was that of Joseph. His language was so convincing and prophetic, it seemed to bring conviction to the hearts of all who were present. I was in the meeting, saw with my own eyes and heard with my own ears all that was said and done, and know for a surety whereof I speak, and I lie not. And a lot of people came from that meeting with that same kind of impression. There were some doubters, and your people, you've talked previously about James Strang and others who just didn't feel like the 12 were the same as Joseph Smith.
Mm-hmm. So at that point, while we now have a transition from the prophet Joseph to Brigham Young, I know there are things going on in the county from those that are not members of the church and are anti-Mormon, but also the things that are going on in the city and among the saints. When do they start thinking in terms of, we're not going to be able to stay in Nauvoo? Was that immediately after the martyrdom, or had there already been talks about having to vacate Nauvoo even before Joseph dies?
Well, let's put a perspective on that first. The anti-Mormons had a reaction after the martyrdom. And first of all, they thought, and this is generalizing, they thought the Mormons' cohesiveness would break, and it didn't. In August of 1844, outsiders warned people in Nauvoo of the absolute necessity of great caution by the saints. A small error on your part, one of the apostles was told, will put the country in a blaze that will not be early extinguished. Wow. So it's dangerous. The saints keep building the temple. That aggravates the anti-Mormons. The assumption is the Mormons finish it, they're going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want them to finish it. The state itself got into the act and repealed the Nauvoo Charter. The people in Nauvoo have to become their own organization, and so we use the existing church structures, the quorums, the bishops, and so on, to keep law and order, so to speak. In 1845, in April conference, we changed the name of the city to the City of Joseph. And the county is edgy by early summer 1845. We have a sheriff appointed or elected in a special election who is pro-Mormon, Jacob Bekenstos, and that aggravates the anti-Mormon. So they're ready to do something kind of like a round two, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So the question becomes, is it time to uproot again? And if we do, where? They always wanted to return to Jackson County, but that was not viable.
Mm-hmm.
So where did they go?
Mm-hmm.
And so they will have looking westward is what will happen.
Interesting. Bill, you talked about the thinking of the saints with regards to the West. Had there been any thinking of church leaders previous to 1845 to the saints moving west, or had they really thought, we're going to stay here and ride out this terrible storm?
The West was such an attraction to all Americans right by now. We have a spirit all over the country that we've identified, historians have called manifest destiny, that it is the manifest destiny of the United States to occupy and annex the entire coast-to-coast stretch of the West. Texas, Oregon, California should be part. And reports coming back from the West excited people everywhere. It was a new unknown area that had a fascination. And so our people in Nauvoo are right on the edge of the United States. And beyond them is the territory of Iowa, which goes a few counties in. But after that, it's pretty much wide open wilderness. Joseph Smith wanted the gospel taken to the Native Americans, and that starts in 1831, and it continues all through his ministry. He sends missionaries 1841 and 42 up into Minnesota and Wisconsin, and in 43 and 4, he sends missionaries into Iowa to work with the Native Americans. And there is that sense of the West is where the Indians are that is part of our leadership thinking, at least. On January 12, 1844, Joseph Smith asked the 12 to send a company to explore Oregon and California and to find a group of Native Americans to work with and to develop a site where we could plant a settlement at least. They asked for volunteers. They got four. So Joseph Smith assigned 14 men to go, including Daniel Spencer, John Fulmer, Charles Shumway, and James Emmett. They were to scout the West, visit the tribes, select a settlement site, and then pilot others there. And this was just months before the martyrdom. So, yeah, the West was very much on the minds at the time of the martyrdom. This group was expected to leave in the spring of 44. Now, other events kind of stopped that from happening, but we still have going on that spring a group called the Council of 50 is organized to manage some of the church's economic and political matters and the Western penetration. And on that Council of 50 are nine apostles and other key people, including James Emmett and Bishop George Miller. March. The Council of 50 discusses how best to secure a resting place in the mountains or some uninhabited region where we can enjoy the liberty of conscience. This is before the martyrdom. You see. The church leadership petitions Congress to authorize the saints to send forces into the West and promote the West, development of the West. So, yeah, we had good interest in the West. At this point, in April, Joseph Smith declares Zion is North and South America, a major new understanding of what Zion is. So the West, yes, was part of their thinking.
Interesting. Well, just last summer, I had the privilege of being back in Nauvoo and the surrounding areas and with one of our colleagues, Richard Bennett, and Dick was talking about that Rocky Mountain prophecy of the prophet Joseph Smith, or attributed to the prophet Joseph. Why don't you share with us of that, you know, there's all this thinking going on and even preparations, but Joseph feels passionately about it for other reasons. Why don't you share with us a little bit about that that prophecy?
All right. We had a number of, again, connections to the West, but in 1842— according to Anson Call's journal, Joseph Smith made a statement that one day the Latter-day Saints would be a mighty people in the Rocky Mountains. And that fits right into what we had just discussed. And what I find interesting is trying to figure out when did they decide to vacate instead of just plant another colony. When did they decide to vacate Nauvoo and move the church west? And as we get after the martyrdom and this, what do we do? Do we stay? Do we go? In 1845, we get the decision being made. In January, the anti-Mormons vowed to drive the saints from Illinois before the temple was finished, feeling that if they finished the temple, they would stay. Look at this one. 1845, John Taylor writes a song called Upper California, Oh, That's the Land for Me. And the verses in that, this is, you know, April of 45. Then join with me, my brethren, and let us hasten there. We'll lift our glorious standard and raise our house of prayer. They're thinking California, which is, by today's maps, this also includes Utah, even into Colorado, clear to the Pacific coast.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Bill, as we've talked about the saints preparing to go the west, and in 1845, I thought it was fascinating that John Taylor song clearly thinking in terms of going to the California. Let's go back and talk even more of what is going on that is going to expedite the saints' decision to vacate Nauvoo.
Well, it's clear by the summer of 1845 that the conditions are too precarious for the saints to stay. And the mob talk and threats make it clear they want the saints out of Illinois. The governor wants us out of Illinois. And the church authorities make that decision by summer of 45 that we're going to leave as a people. The conditions exploded in September. That is, the anti-Mormons are getting impatient, and they decide that the vulnerability the Mormons have is not Nauvoo, but the outlying settlements where the people are smaller in number and defenseless, basically. And so we have night riders and arsonists go to work. Now, the best example that I've studied is Morley's Settlement, which is about 26 miles south of Nauvoo. And Morley's Settlement was the heart of a basically a stake that had up to 500 members in it. And it was a little the heart of Morley's, the downtown, if you want to call it that, had shops and stores and that sort of thing. And in September, the anti-Mormons, and they called themselves that with pride, got to work. And they attacked Edmund Durfee's home. They set fire to some of the buildings and ran. Now, the Durfees put the fire out. That evening, the mob fired shots at the guards, and they set fire to the Edmondson house. The next day, they set fire to the Durfees' property again, shot at the children, and missed. They set fire to Isaac Morley's shop. They shot at James C. Snow and put his house on fire. They set fire to the Whiting's chair shop, and they torched three more homes. September 12th, this is in a three-day period. The LDS people say, okay, we'll leave. Buy us out. Make us an offer. And they got no offers. And more buildings were set on fire. Solomon Hancock, who is one of the key people in the community, said, the mob is determined to destroy us. And so the word is from Nauvoo, evacuate. Get out of there. September 15th, there's more burning. The Everett's home was burned, the barn, and 400 bushels of wheat. It's a bad situation. And so Nauvoo people start a practice that we had in Missouri, and that is, if people need help moving, we will help them move. And we'll see it as part of the trek west, too. But they send down wagons from Nauvoo to help move the Morley settlement people into safety in Nauvoo. Bloodshed in the county as the sheriff tries to track down some of the fleeing arsonists, if you will, are shot. And by September 14th, the leaders say to the governor, we will leave in the spring. Help these people call us off. We are going to leave as a spring. Brigham Young tells the Quincy Committee, trying to make peace between these warring factions north of Quincy, tells them, we are going to leave. Back off. Eliza R. Snow writes a poem called Let Us Go as part of this. October General Conference, which is held in the enclosed temple. The interior isn't finished, but the outside and the roof are on. The announcement is made.
So that'd be October 1845.
1845. The saints are told, we are going to leave in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're smart people. You don't leave in winter.
Mm-hmm.
We'll discuss that later. But mm-hmm. in the spring is when the grass grows and the water runs, and that's when you want to travel. There's a covenant made in the Nauvoo Temple. The saints were told, when we left Missouri, we promised not to leave the poor behind. Let's mm-hmm. do it again. And so there's a Nauvoo covenant that really becomes the foundation for Mormon immigration policy for the next 20 years, that we will move the poor. And then in November, down in Morley Settlement, Edmund Durfee, whose home had been torched, and he is my ancestor, went back down to try to harvest some of the crops that were there, and he stays at Solomon Hancock's home. And that night after dark, about 10 o'clock, the torchers come again, set fire to the barn. The men run out to the house to see what's going on, and shots ring out, and Edmund Durfee is shot through the neck and killed. And that is part of the last mobbing, so to speak. And then it'll be a watch and see, are the Mormons really going to leave or not?
Mm-hmm. Are all of the people in the outlying settlements, are they all gathered into Nauvoo at that time?
Only the ones in danger, the ones that it felt like would be the mobs were threatening.
And so it's mostly on the Hancock County, in Hancock County, not so much on the Iowa side or things like that.
Correct. But the anti-Mormons all around were watching what was going on there and basically saying, we'll do the same thing if you don't keep your promise to leave.
And so then you say they've made a plan and told those mobocrats and others, the elected officials, the governor, that they're planning on leaving in the spring. So now from that October 1845 conference, they're resolved that come spring 1846, Nauvoo's going to be vacated.
Yes. And as a lead-in, what will next happen is – two major concerns. One is preparing to go, which is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot of factors involved there. And the other is to get the temple finished and for the saints to receive their endowments.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. And what was the – you have both of those very critical events. Let's talk about why do they feel so passionate about finishing the temple if they're at gunpoint being chased out of their city? What is it that is driving them at the peril of their lives to stick around to finish the temple?
When Joseph Smith was in Liberty Jail, he had a timeout, and it became a learning time for him to put all the pieces together of revelations he'd had before and understandings. So in Nauvoo, he becomes the prophet teacher, a role he never really could enjoy till then. And he introduced a number of explanations about doctrine. And the temple became paramount in his teachings in Nauvoo. And the baptisms for the dead were started. But he knew there had to be fuller temple endowments given to the Latter-day Saints. And so he insisted the temple be the priority in Nauvoo. And Revelation told the saints, you must finish the temple or you'll be out, cast out with your kindred dead. So there was a feeling, yes, we've got to do it even if we are leaving, but we will do it and receive temple blessings before we have to go out and face the wilderness without temple endowment.
And so
that was important to them to have that strength, if you will.
So as Joseph is teaching the importance of the temple and all of the blessings associated with that, now they're being ready to be driven from their homes. Brigham still feels that heavy responsibility that the temple is directly related to survival as they now leave to go on their path west.
That's how I see it.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful, beautiful concept. We're grateful to have had Bill Hartley, Professor Bill Hartley, with us today as we have begun talking about the preparations for the saints to leave Nauvoo. We hope that you will listen to us in our next episode when we continue to talk about how the saints are now preparing for the exodus from Nauvoo and the very real challenges that they were going to face. On Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.